Hi there, welcome to Protecting Your Practice. I'm Dr. Dave Yud. This is Dan Mayer. Hey, Dan.
Hello.
Today we have a guest. Our guest is Dr. Elizabeth Jerome. She's the Executive Director of Wellspring Child and Family Psychology in Fredericksburg, Virginia, which she co-owns with two other psychologists. She's been in practice for 15 years treating kids and adults with trauma histories, chronic stress, and early attachment disruptions. She's an EMDR certified therapist and consultant, and assist with EMDR trainings with other clinicians. Very impressive. She's here to talk about all things personnel related, and we'll go into how she recruits and hires clinicians, her employee retention practices, and how to think about termination should it prove to be necessary. Beth, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you so much for coming. I think this is now our second guest that we're having in the David era of the
It's
podcast.
nice to not just hear the two of us yammer on at each other and be
Oh,
like,
100%.
we're delighted to insert a little other energy here. Beth, first, could you tell us a little bit about your practice?
Sure. So Wellspring is a relatively small practice in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Like you said, I own the practice with two other psychologists. And we actually started Wellspring nearly 10 years ago. So this summer will be our 10-year anniversary. So we provide services for children, adolescents, adults, also couples and families. We do psychotherapy, psychiatry, medication management. We do some parent training courses. A variety of groups. We also have a nutritionist and we do intensive therapy retreats. So, right now we have 16 total employees, 12 psychologists or master's level therapists. We have a wonderful psychiatrist. We have a psychiatric nurse practitioner student. And we have a dietitian and then two support staff, a practice manager, and an administrative assistant to psychiatry.
Wonderful. Sounds like you really, it's multidisciplinary, which
It
is
is. Yes. Yeah.
one stop shop.
Yeah. That's really nice. We can collaborate on patient care.
So, this being an episode about personnel, tell us a little bit about how you tend to find folks to work at your practice, whether they're clinicians or support staff. What are some avenues that you look for recruitment?
Yeah, so a lot of times it ends up being word of mouth. I think when we have an opening, people know about the practice. We have a reputation in the community. So if people are looking, a lot of our employees just kind of reached out to me directly when they were looking for a position. But when we advertise, we typically use Indeed, and then we post open positions on our website. And we do post some ads on social networking groups or Facebook, but we don't do a whole lot of social media at this point, although I imagine that's something that will change in the future, increase with the times.
I was going to ask a quick question. Have you found difficulty in hiring, qualified staff? Has that been an issue for you at all?
Yes, I mean, I think that's always the biggest challenge is finding highly qualified providers. And we have our philosophy is to be slow to hire. So we don't rush. We don't fill positions just because they need to be filled. We take our time and we wait for the right person. So yeah, sometimes our positions will stay open for quite a while, sometimes maybe 6 months even. Yeah, it's we have an abundance of clients, and the challenge is always finding good quality clinicians.
That's always the tough part, is balancing the demand versus the supply that you're trying to provide. And I imagine that can be very easy to get out of balance.
Yeah. I mean, we could definitely hire pretty much always hire more people if we had the space. I mean, once our office space is filled up, we
Yeah.
can't continue to hire anyways, but
Do you feel like there's the plan is, or is your kind of thought to ex keep expanding, or is there a limit to how big you want to grow?
I think there's a limit. It's always a balance of demand and need. We want to be able to serve the area the best we can. So it's hard to turn people away. But I think the focus ha for us has to be on quality over quantity. So we would rather have a little bit smaller practice with high quality providers than, we have three, four locations where we are having to hire anybody who applies. Every time you open a new location, you have a whole lot more overhead, right? And there's a lot more pressure to hire new people. So, not that we wouldn't expand some in the future, but we do expand very slowly.
It sounds like you're trying to be very deliberate. I mean, that's true of just about any business. If it expands too quickly or at a rate that the business isn't ready to handle it, quality suffers.
We want to be bursting at the seams before we kind of make some kind of expansion.
Random question I have is when hiring or the people you have hired, because of the area that you're in, do you find that there is specific things that are beneficial to the community around you in terms of how you're hiring? And I guess what I'm asking is, there are services that your practice may offer that a practice, in Northern Maryland might not offer. And in terms of the people they hire, there may be different needs that you are seeing, are necessary in your community versus somewhere else. And is that something that has impacted your hiring or changed, how you hire and who you hire?
That's a good question. We are a relatively small town, surrounded by a couple of major cities.
And a
So,
battlefield, I hear.
yeah, there's if we can find clinicians who are interested in, Civil War, Revolutionary War history, they'd probably really like Fredericksburg.
Fredericksburg is your town.
That's your place. Wellspring is your place. Honestly, when I moved here, it was considered an underserved area. And although there are more services available now, I would say Fredericksburg is still a relatively underserved area in terms of mental health services. So what happens is you end up having a lot of generalists. And so I think the people that we're hiring need to be generalists to some extent, but we also try to encourage clinicians to specialize in certain areas as well, develop a specialization, because one thing our area really needs are specialized providers.
It sounds like there are already enough generalists, but the specialties are
Well, I would say there
just
aren't even enough specialists. I mean, generalists probably, we could use more of
That's
everything,
true
but
across the board. Every practice I talk to, every practice that's more than just one solo practitioner, who has a wait list of clients, if part of one of the factors of that I've heard, I've been told, is that it's because they can never find enough people to bring into the practice, like you said, even those who are qualified or, quality candidates to service that need. And I feel that's a big pressing issue across the industry.
When people reach out to you and answer those ads, what are some of the first things that you do with those applications or with those requests? How do you organize them in your head? How do you respond to them, and what are you looking for in that in those first steps?
Yeah, I have a fairly systematic way of screening the initial applications. First of all, I'm making sure that they're actually a licensed therapist. So
So you'll do the quick lookup.
I will do the lookup. We had a psychologist in a nearby town, not at our practice, of course, but who had been practicing for many years, and it turned out she wasn't even licensed the
Oh
whole time.
no.
Not only that, she hadn't even gone to a graduate program in psychology of any kind.
Oh, so like fraudulent top to bottom.
Fraudulent fact. Yeah, no, she was in jail for that. But the crazy thing, well, that was also a little bit crazy. But the other crazy thing about this is this woman was hired by a pediatrics practice
Oh,
despite not
God.
being licensed. So while it seems obvious to me, maybe worth saying, always check first thing and make sure people's licenses are active, valid, and look for any, board or disciplinary actions on that license.
I'm so glad you said that out loud, because honestly, I would have just assumed, and then Dan would have screamed at me.
No,
It
I'm sitting here laughing because as you're talking, I just had this image pop in my mind of I love the movie Fletch, and
Oh,
when
great
Fletch walks
film,
in,
great film.
Fletch walks in, he goes, "I'm Dr. Rosen
Dr.
Rosen."
Rosenfinger, yeah.
Right,
Dr. Rosenfinger, yeah.
you're right.
It is Chevy Chase's best film.
It's one of the best ones, but. Anyway, I don't want to get sidetracked, but that's why I was laughing, because I totally could picture that. Like, of course, that's such an important thing to make sure the credentials are in place, obviously.
So that's just one of the initial like things I'm looking for. And then educational background, did they go to a good program, an accredited program versus some obscure online program, just
Right.
general. And then I look at longevity of previous jobs. So if somebody's changing jobs every 6 months or multiple times in a year, that can be unattractive.
Can I ask a quick question on that? And I'm going to actually come back to this when we talk about termination a bit. But when you're hiring, do you do reference checks?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I do. And I can go through our whole process here in a bit, but absolutely, we do reference checks, we do background checks, criminal checks. Yeah.
I honestly thought to wondered if it makes sense to do a background check, given that everybody has to get background checked for their license. At least in Maryland, we do.
I totally want to hear what you have to say about this, because I have a comment on that, Dave, but I want to hear what you have to say first about the background checks.
There's no way I would hire someone without doing a background check.
That's how I feel.
Personally, it's easy, it's low cost, and it can't hurt. And then I've done my due diligence, so I'm not relying on a, even if the board does. And I don't know, Dan, I don't know if you know if in Virginia they do a background check for licensure or not.
I don't know. My wife would absolutely know. She's a practitioner. But what I will tell you, and I've talked about this with my wife, is that the reason I'm supportive of background checks is because if someone's been in practice for 10 years, 5 years, 3 years, yes, they did a background check for their licensure, but you have no idea what's happened in the last year, 6 months, particularly in a practice like yours, where you may be working with adolescents, teenagers, anyone, a minor. Anything where that kind of background check can bring forth information that would suggest or lead you to conclude that this person could be a danger, right? That wouldn't show up have shown up on the original background check. So, I 100% agree with you. I think it's important. I don't know. I just want to say for everyone listening, I don't know for every practice that's always like the standard. But I do think that that's a really good compliance, action, I think, for by practices to take generally.
Yeah. And then the other thing, the one other thing that I will say I do that other people may not is I require cover letters.
Interesting.
And a cover letter gives you a lot of information about somebody, a sense of a person that you may not get just from their CV. I find those to be really helpful. And in those, I'm looking to see, did people do some research? Do they know who they're applying to? Do they make comments about why they would be a good fit for our practice in particular? I'm also looking at, what do they value in their work? What do they value in a work environment? Can they articulate their interests and goals? And asking for a cover letter is also a really good way to screen, especially from places like Indeed, because some people just send their application out to every single job they might possibly fit with in Indeed. And what I've found is that if I ask then for a cover letter, people who aren't really interested won't do it. And so I'm narrowing down my applicant pool right away to
Interesting.
people who are actually interested and willing to take the time to write that cover letter.
Do you, because you're hiring psychologists, because you're hiring people who may be doing a lot of writing, does that cover letter also kind of give you some inkling, at least upfront, of what their writing ability is?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I've gotten resumes, even not cover letter, but resumes with half sentences. And well, I'm not going to hold a misspelled word against someone or, a grammatical error. If you have half a sentence in a document you're sending out to people, that tells me a lot. Yeah, I don't want to have to micromanage somebody's notes, and I want them to be decent writers. So yeah, definitely.
I remember I once worked for an attorney, and she told me once, and as I kind of moved up in that firm a bit, I was helping with some of the hiring stuff, and I was looking at resumes, and she said, and cover letters, and I remember her saying, "I want you to look carefully at the sentence structure." And I was like, "Why?" And she said, "Because I want to know if they're putting the periods and the commas and things in the right place." And I said, "Why does that matter?" She said, "Because it's attention to detail. Those are the things that matter, that, if you don't do that, then I know that you're not careful proofreader, right? And as an attorney, that matters. And so, you know, absolutely, I think from your perspective, that totally makes sense to me that you're, you know, all these things are kind of feeding into, you know, how does this candidate stack up and qualify for you guys?
So I imagine once you get the cover letter and you're reading it and you see what you want to see or what you hope to see, you start to get a sense of whether this person might be a decent fit for what your practice does. If they sort of pass that level, so to speak, what would you do then?
So if I think they might be a good fit in general for the practice, the next step is I reach out to them and schedule a 30-minute initial phone call, approximately 30 minutes. And I somewhat informally talk to them about the practice. There are two main goals that drive our practice. One is to provide good quality patient care. So I want applicants to know this goal. That we want the community to know if they send somebody to Wellspring, that patient's going to get good care no matter which provider they see. So I want a consistently good quality of patient care. So we want skilled clinicians. And then our second main goal is to have a good place to work. We want to come in and have a supportive, healthy, ethical workplace that's collaborative. So I want people who can work well with others. So in that initial phone call, I talk a little bit about both of those overarching goals of our practice. And then I just want to get a sense in that phone call, is this person looking for private practice? Do they understand how the PACE, you know, works? What populations do they see? And is that going to be potentially a good fit for us and our needs at that time? And just answer any general questions. And then if that seems like after that call, I feel like this might be a good fit mutually, I'll schedule the initial interview. So we have a little bit of an extensive interview process.
So well, that's part. Go ahead, Dave, go ahead.
That's part of why I asked you to do this episode, because, you know, we've talked about this before and you've explained to me just how thorough you are and how that pays off on the back end with generally satisfied employees, or I suppose you'll tell us what the impacts are. But that's a lot of why I was excited to have this conversation. I know that the more work you put in on the back end, the better the payoff is.
Yeah.
I have two questions on that topic. One is, are there any questions that you specifically ask, even if they're off the cuff or a little bit more, you know, less typical, not just like, where did you go to school? And, you know, did you ask the kind of elicit feedback to see or kind of gauge this person? That's my first question. Second question is are there things that people can tell you or tell you that you're like immediately like, bing, okay, that's a red flag, that just kind of set off that alarm bell in your mind?
Yes.
Do you ask them, if you were an animal, right, which animal would you be and why?
Right. Yeah, right.
Everybody knows that those are the questions that get at what you really want to know.
Right. What's your favorite ice cream?
You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I can't say I ask anything quite like that.
Nothing quite that insipid.
Am I looking for red flags? Yes. You know, all throughout this process, we're looking for red flags, and without calling anybody out. But I have definitely had some.
There's a story there.
I have some good stories. Some good stories, but I've had people sound like they're on drugs in that initial call, had people cry, not typically, but there have been a couple of interesting initial phone calls, you know, people who rant and rave about past employers and how everyone's done them wrong. That can be a red flag for sure.
I imagine.
Yeah. So,
if their employer had done them wrong, that just exhibits poor judgment.
Right. Especially at this stage in the interview, you don't want to lead with that.
You know?
Or if an employer's done them wrong, that's fine. But I'm looking to see, can they talk about that in a well thought out, kind of balanced way?
Right.
In a way that kind of recognizes their own strengths and weaknesses as well. So there are ways to talk about bad work experiences in the past.
So when someone concludes like, all right, you're like, okay, that's
I say, oh, that'd be a fun person to work with.
I would hire Matthew McConaughey.
Absolutely.
Just to have him around the office. Maybe
Oh,
I wouldn't.
absolutely.
Yeah, just for vibes. That's all.
Absolutely.
So, and then, yeah, so a lot of those questions that you're asking about, Dan, I think come more in the initial interview. So once
Sure.
we set up that hour and a half interview, typically that's with two of us partners and the candidate. And in that interview, we ask a lot about work environment, right? We ask a lot about what is a good work environment for you? What are you looking for? What doesn't work well? You know, tell us about a conflict you've had or a difficult person you've worked with and how did you handle that? We ask, of course, about clinical skills, right? Case examples. We'll sometimes give case examples. Sometimes we do that in the interview. Sometimes we send case examples and ask for a written response. We want to make sure people have good clinical skills. And that's something that's a little hard to assess when you're not seeing people in action.
What I'm hearing you say, and it's really interesting to hear you talk about this, is, you know, you're really kind of actually doing two things, right? You're laying some groundwork even before they walk into your office for this interview, right? And there's a little bit of preparation that a really good candidate is going to do. And that's not just about researching your practice, but also, you know, coming up with case examples and things like that, being prepared for the interview, then you're talking about it. And so I think that's a useful point for practitioners who are listening is, you know, that's how you kind of flesh out, is this person someone who has a lot of experience? And that's an interesting consideration. And also then I would assume then, and during that initial, that, you know, that 2 hour interview or the two person interview, that's when you ask about, you know, which letter of the alphabet would you be? So I understand.
At the very end.
Right? At the very end. Right. Okay.
Give us an honest answer.
It's crucial information.
So, you know, we're asking about also their dedication to professional development. This is a big one for me.
Okay.
Sometimes we hire new clinicians. They don't have a ton of experience. But in those cases, I want somebody who is smart and has good potential and who's really dedicated to ongoing professional development, who's willing to learn and grow. So we ask questions about that. And I'm also looking at receptiveness to feedback in that interview. So within the interview, I will sometimes point something out or ask, you know, a question that is a little different maybe than kind of a counterpoint to something they said. And I just see how they react. You know, I want to see, can someone consider alternative viewpoints and things like that. So those are some of the things we're looking for in that. That's kind of our main interview. Then we do a second interview typically that's less formal, where we have the candidate meet with a another employee so that they can get the inside scoop on the practice.
Nice.
Wow. I'm very impressed. That's a really extensive interview process. I'm sure yields, you know, quality candidates, but that's interesting that you guys have mapped this whole process out for yourselves.
Yeah, we've learned over the years, you know, and really we don't want somebody who doesn't want to be here, right? That doesn't do anyone any good. So we do want people to get an honest idea of what we have to offer, you know, and one of the ways we do that is have people meet with the clinician, the other clinician for the second interview, because we're not there, a partner's not there, right? They just can get an honest opinion about what is it like to really work at Wellspring. And we feel confident, you know, of course, they're going to say good things because I think our employees are really happy. Another thing that we don't do is that I see a lot is inflate earnings estimates. I think this is really tempting when people put out advertisements for psychology positions. I have seen some dramatically inflated earnings estimates that I just can't imagine are accurate. Unless you're working, you know, seeing 40 patients a week or something, which is not a really healthy work-life balance. So I try to be very conservative when I give people earnings estimates. And I think that helps us to retain people too. We want to make sure people can meet their financial goals.
How do you structure payroll? Do you pay per clinical hour or per billings or salary? What is your strategy there?
Yeah, for most of our clinicians, we do a percentage-based split.
Okay.
Yeah,
got
based
it.
On their collections.
Do you mentioned a moment ago just how much professional development is important to the practice. Is that something that you all put resources behind? And if so, what does that look like?
We do. I mean, right now, I'm actually working to become an EMDR trainer. And part of my goal in doing that is so I can train our staff at an affordable rate or a reduced rate. And we have to charge something because I have to pay, I have to actually
Right.
pay the person who owns the curriculum, I guess.
Sure.
But I'm hoping to be able to provide some EMDR training. We provide 2 years of post-licensure supervision for all newer clinicians because that's such a critical time in professional development, I think, those first couple years outside of grad school where you're out on your own, but you aren't super experienced yet. I think people really like having that additional support. And I do a provide a free EMDR consultation group for our employees since that's my thing. But we have other senior clinicians that provide consultation on other topics as well. So yeah, we pour a lot of resources into ongoing professional development.
Cool. So you get through the first interview, you still like them. You do the second interview with the employee, you still like them, or and they still like you. What's next?
Yep, so then we do reference checks. We require three professional references and at least one in a supervisory role. Anybody can find three friends to, to give them a good reference. But if you ask for someone in a supervisory role, I think you get a lot of good information by doing that. And then we do a background and criminal check, just to make sure. And then if all that clears, we do a formal offer and we get a contract to them and review the contract with them. And then once that contract is signed by both of us, we move forward.
Do you how do you feel about neutral reference responses? And so in other words, and I've seen this on the practice side of things where, a prospective employer will call up the other practice and they'll say, well, we can verify that they worked here at these dates and that they were an employee and they won't go further into detail on that. Do you feel
No.
like that raises flags to you? Do you care about that? Does that
That wouldn't even count for me.
okay.
So we have a standard set of 10 reference questions that we ask every reference, and it's along the lines of a lot of the things we've asked the candidate in the interviews.
So if an employer said, well, I can't really answer those questions. I can only tell you they worked here. That would raise a red flag for you. If they, yeah.
And if the
And
other
I'll tell you from
references.
the employer side, because I, as the attorney working with practices, that's
Yeah.
exactly why when they don't have anything, I always say, it's like your mom said, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. And that's usually, I say other employers will pick up on that. When you say, I've got nothing else to say, that's a big red flag to the employers who are asking, in my opinion. So that's why I want to hear from you, is like from your perspective, the kind of the other side of
Definitely.
that. Interesting.
No, a neutral reference is a bad reference in my book. People don't often give bad references, but like you
Correct.
said, if they weren't happy with the person, it'll just be very neutral.
That's right. I mean, if somebody asked me to be a reference and I did not have good things to say, I would just say it's not in your interest for me to be your a reference.
You would be surprised though, and I'm sure you could agree as well, that Elizabeth, that you'd be surprised at how many, practice owners have come to me and said, well, I just, this person we let go, they've now had their next employer come to us. What do we say?
Yeah. Oh God, that's awkward. So they sign the contract, everybody's happy, they start working. Tell us, like, you've already kind of talked about this. How do you think of employee retention? How do you think of structuring the practice so that the folks that work with you stay happy?
I think the biggest thing is creating and nurturing a good work environment. We do that by checking in frequently, being available. I'm typically on the phone 2 to 3 evenings a week, talking to my coworkers about cases or CPS reports or ethical or legal questions. Of course, referring to them to the lawyer as I should, Dan, not answering those myself sometimes, if they're legal questions.
DPS questions are always fun.
Yes, So, we're just available, and that's part of my job is to be available after hours and take that time, and I don't mind doing that. So creating that environment, we do try to support clinicians' interests as well and their goals. So, for example, our psychiatrist wanted to precept a psychiatric nurse practitioner student. And so we were very supportive of that and helped set that up. And there's no financial gain for us doing that, but it's something she's interested in, and we want to support that. If people want to do a certain group or teach a certain class, we will help them advertise, we'll help them get materials together, we'll help them think through the logistics of setting it up. So the way I look at it is we're really there to coach and help people build their practice in the way that they want it to. Our practitioners are very independent and autonomous overall, so we don't have to micromanage them. And we're hiring people who don't need to be micromanaged as well. So I think that's the way that we help to retain employees, is by creating that type of an environment, supporting them and helping them to have ownership over their practice. We do also some fun things like, well, fun for me. I don't know if you would think this is fun, but we did like a wreath making holiday activity where someone came in and brought all this stuff and we had to make wreaths. That was a lot of fun. We do some parties and get-togethers and things like that.
Nice.
Yeah, even little things like we provide snacks and coffee and tea at the office.
Those things make such a big difference, though. I remember being in my internship and it being a miserable experience, and then they brought a Keurig machine in, and we were all like, this is the greatest thing ever. Oh my God.
Well, and that goes to the whole idea of creating a culture that people want to stay in, right? And that then builds in turn, having people work for your practice or invest in your practice, and that cuts down on your own costs because then you're not constantly having to hire to replace those people, right? You had mentioned something, one question. You had mentioned about contracts. So do you use employer contracts?
We do. For providers,
And I'm just curious, for you guys, what do you find is the benefit of those versus, straight at will employment?
That's a good question. I think for us, it's just setting a mutual expectation, so that we know exactly what we expect of each other. It's also really nice to have a contract to go back to, and it's just in writing. So we're held to our part of it, they're held to their part. It takes any question out of things, certain areas. If you can spell it out in a contract, I think it just makes it easier to have things very explicitly stated and everybody knows what's expected.
So let's say you hire, everything goes well, that's wonderful. But as we all know, this is an imperfect system, and sometimes things don't go the way you want, and certain employees are unhappy or are just things aren't working out. Tell us a little bit about how you choose to manage that before we get to it's time to end the employment. What are some things that you guys do to try and get things back on track?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, our main focus is to hire well, and that eliminates 95% of the problems, but
Right, exactly.
it's still going to happen. And in 10 years of practice, we've really only had one incident that was kind of difficult, more difficult to deal with. But for small issues, so things like unwritten notes, administrative issues, frequent cancellations, things that are significant enough, but nothing major. We have a formal employee action plan, which is a form that we have to document whatever's going on. And in those situations, we typically sit down one-on-one, usually myself and the employee, and we talk about what's happening. I try to get information about, is there anything that we can do to support or help resolve the issue? What does the employee need to do to resolve this issue? And we jointly come up with a plan, including specific goals or remedies, and then the time that those remedies will be achieved. So, for example, if someone's chronically behind on notes, we would meet, talk about why it's important to be up to date with notes, get a sense of what's going on. Is there family issues or something that's getting in their way? Do they need more time to write notes? Do they need to end sessions earlier? We help brainstorm through what are some ways that could help them? And then we might write down, okay, you're going to have half of your notes done by next Monday and the other half done by the following Monday. We both sign it. And then if those action plans are completed, that's great. If not, we would probably meet again, depending on the issue. And sometimes we could do another action plan. Or sometimes that might be a reason, you know, that could be a reason for termination if things are just not getting done. Typically, we're only terminating an employee in a pretty drastic situation, at least a provider. So that would be something like an ethical issue. If we ever had a problem with patient care, patients being mistreated or something like that, or if people violate the terms of their contract in some kind of major way, those would be situations where we would probably do more an immediate termination.
Right.
So if we have to do that, it's going to be very, very clear why. So we have a meeting, we try to be very factual and not emotional.
I imagine that might be very difficult to keep emotions out of something like that.
You know, it's extremely hard. It's extremely hard because in these situations, you're often dealing with someone who's been disrespectful or inappropriate, and you have to hear them out and not argue with their point of view. You know, we try to give people space to voice their concerns. And yeah, it can be hard. So we take very detailed notes during all of this, and we always consult our attorney. So before I would even have that initial meeting, I would call the attorney, make sure that we're doing, get an outside perspective, make sure we're doing the right thing, make sure it's ethical, legal, all that. If find out, is there anything specific we need to document, anything specific that we need to do? Is this an appropriate grounds for termination?
Do you find, there's sometimes where you might follow a path of corrective action, but you mentioned ethical issues. Are there times where you say, okay, listen, this is a action or behavior that's, I'm sorry, we're just going to have to skip that and go right to termination. We just cannot have you here further.
Yes,
Is
and yeah. So that's what I was saying with the when we go that route,
Okay,
we're not
gotcha.
doing an action. Like if it's an ethical violation, if it's a patient care issue, if it's a employment contract violation, you know, things like that are would be immediate termination. We're not going to keep somebody on who's engaging in something that's, you know, potentially destructive to either the practice or the patients.
Right.
That is extremely rare. Luckily for us, so
Let's hope it stays extremely rare.
yes.
So
I had one other question, and I said I was going to come back to this. And so when an employee leaves, let's say they are someone who says, they were terminated for cause, and they tell their next employer, oh yes, please go ahead and contact Dr. Jerome. And they call you up. What is your position then on what you tell other prospective employees, employers, I should say?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't imagine that would happen because I'm very direct with people, and I think they know where I stand. So I think people know what to expect from me. So I can't imagine they would have give me as a reference. But if that did happen, I would say I don't feel that I can be a reference for this person.
I'm hearing Taylor Swift in my head right now. Like, we are never ever getting back together. Don't call us. We'll call you.
I just want to say this is a Taylor Swift free podcast. Please,
I
please,
have a 9-year-old
please.
son with female friends, so Taylor Swift has now become a constant in my household.
It's a constant in mine too. Okay, so you move toward forward with termination. And then you are stuck with a caseload of clients that you now are obligated to manage because you need to manage abandonment issues. How do you think about that? How do you work that in? What does that look like?
That's a great question. And that is absolutely our biggest priority when somebody not only is terminated, because we rarely deal with that, but when someone moves out of state, if they have an emergency, we had a clinician out for months after an accident.
Oh
When someone
no.
is on maternity leave, you know, we try really hard to make sure all the clients get appropriate services, but that is logistically difficult. You know, we're constantly full. And it's hard to relocate, you know, 30 or 40 people into already full caseloads. So there have been times when the three of us partners have had to increase our caseload temporarily to get some people in. We try to fill any openings that other providers in our practice have. And our priority is not to keep people in the practice in those situations. The priority is to just get appropriate care. So we also have an extensive referral list in the community. You know, I will call my friends and ask for favors.
You say
a certain person on this podcast.
I don't know what you're talking about.
So we do everything we can, you know. So in short, we do our very, very best to make sure that patients get the best care possible. There's only so much you can control in these situations. And as practice owners, I think we just have to do the best we can to navigate these situations.
I think it's been really insightful to have you on. I appreciate it because I'm hoping that people listening are hearing some of the things that you guys do in your practice, because I think you guys are doing everything right. And I think it's, you know, from your hiring to how you're handling it, that's my perspective as an attorney working with practices is exactly what we tell our clients to do. So I think it's been really useful. A lot of the stuff you said, I hope people take away and maybe incorporate into their own practices.
Well, thank you so much, Beth, for coming on and for sharing your wisdom with us. This has been very helpful for me to just think about my own practice, and I appreciate you educating us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Yeah. Where can people find you?
So we have a website, wellspringva.com. They can call our main number that's on that website. And then my email is drjerome@wellspringva.com. Just drjerome at wellspringva.com.
And if people are like, man, I want to go work there, that they can also contact you with that.
They can. Yeah, I'm always open to talking to people about possibilities with our practice. Yep.
They can listen to this podcast so they know exactly what to expect.
A lesson in how to navigate our interview
Correct.
Process.
I know. And they already know they won't have to worry about any weird questions, right? You know, what letter you are, what food you are, and like that. So it's great.
You could just, every applicant, you could send them this episode and just be like, just right. Listen to this and then like,
we'll read it. Listen to this first, then
right,
call
right.
me.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you at the next one. Take care.
Take care, everyone.
Thank you for listening to Protecting Your Practice. Be sure to visit protectingyourpractice.com to connect with us, continue the conversation, and access additional information. As a reminder, the information on this podcast does not constitute legal advice. Listeners should contact their own attorney or paid consultant for all decisions regarding their own practice.